Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, we do a show-host portfolio discussion with Jared Dillian, author of the popular investment newsletter, The Daily Dirt Nap, and also author of the new book, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. We talk to Jared about how he invests, the importance of diversification, and his average portfolio. We get his views on debt, housing, leaving money to kids, and much more. The episode blends a show us your portfolio set of questions with lots of ideas and concepts that Jared outlines in his book. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Jared Dillian. And just one more thing before we start. We're very excited to announce our first ever charity podcast day in conjunction with our friends at Spot Gamma. On April 30th, we will host an all-day live broadcast on our YouTube channel to benefit the Susan G. Komen Foundation. We will interview 24 guests from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The guests will include many of the most popular guests we've had in the podcast, plus many other experts from the investing, macro, and options worlds. Andy Constant will be kicking off a live stream as our first guest at 8 a.m. To be notified when we go live, go to the Excess Returns channel on YouTube, click on the live link, and then click on Notify Me under the P&L for a purpose image. We hope you'll join us on the 30th to support what is a great cause. Thank you so much. Jared, how are you? Thank you very much for joining us today.
Good. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Earlier in the year, you published your new book, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. And there it is. We got the book, little product placement. Awesome. But I think the book is about, we're going to talk about this, but, you know, the tactics and the decisions and the mindset that's needed for people to effectively deal with finances and their money and long-term wealth creation. And how, you know, I think a few decisions along the way can make a big financial impact for a lot of people.
Yep.
But I think what we want to do with you is take the opportunity to kind of talk about this in the context of one of the shows that we do, which is Show Us Your Portfolio, where we talk to people like yourself that are in the markets day in and day out about how they go about managing their personal portfolio and their philosophy, if you will, on generating wealth for themselves and their families. And so that's kind of where we're going to go. It's going to be this combination of concepts from the book, but also trying to pull out some things that you might do personally that I think you talked about in the book, but, you know, sort of maybe beyond that a little bit as well.
Yep.
So this is going to be good. And by the way, just want to say the book is doing very well in the first 90 days. I was looking, it's got almost 500 reviews on Amazon and it's a 4.8 star, which is pretty amazing. I think it's that right there is a testament to that people are finding value from the book. So congratulations to you on that.
Thanks. You know, the book has been a big success, and I want everybody to read it. You know, I mean, it's funny, like, you know, people buy it, but I wish I've sold millions of copies. Like, I think the message is really relevant for a lot of people. So,
yeah, well, hopefully maybe this conversation gets a few more sold. So with these conversations, we kind of like to start about asking you about what your long-term goals and objectives are with your investments in your portfolio. And so when you think about that for yourself, how would you sort of articulate that?
Well, nobody should do what I do. You know, I trade pretty aggressively. I have very concentrated positions and things at certain points in time, but I also have a portfolio that is truly, when I say diversified, I mean, it's diversified. There's a lot of uncorrelated bets, and my goal is to make 10 to 14% a year, in perpetuity. And some years are better, some years are worse. I've been off to a pretty good start this year. But like I said, like, my portfolio is X-rated, you know, very concentrated positions, a lot of risk. I've been managing money for, well, if you go back to the Lehman days, you know, I was trading prop in 2007 and 8. So I've been doing it for a while.
And are the goals with the portfolio, I mean, do you think about things like retirement or, you know, leaving money to relatives or just having peace of mind with your wealth?
Well, my goal is to make infinity and my goal is to not retire. I have no plans on retiring. I've seen a lot of people who have retired badly, who have not taken advantage of the time they've had in their retirement. So, you know, I plan to work into my 70s, maybe even my 80s, and make as much money as possible. I don't have any kids. My wife is probably going to outlive me. She's probably going to live to be like 130. She's just in like great physical shape. So, but it's all going to go to charity when we pass away. So
let me just add, you kind of took the, we always have a question about retirement, which you already answered, but I'm curious with your wife, do you, I mean, you're in the markets, you do this for a living with multiple different businesses related to the stock market and educating and people subscribing and paying you for, you know, your wisdom and knowledge, but is she interested in this stuff or not? Or is it mostly like 90-95% you, and then she's just there, kind of knows generally what's going on? I'm just curious.
Well, she's absorbed a lot of it over the years. You know, I've been working in finance since 99, so it's been 25 years. She's picked up on a lot of it. You know, we actually, like I said in the book, we actually keep our money separate. So I have my pile of money. She has her pile of money. You know, she generally follows my advice on what to do with it, but, we actually keep our money completely separate. So
what do you think the advantages of doing it that way are? Cause you see people do it both ways. You know, you see some people integrate everything together and you see some people separate it out. Like what do you think at a high level, like the advantages and disadvantages of that are?
Well, I think that we are all responsible for our own financial education. And you see a lot of relationships where you have a husband and a wife, and typically it's the wife who says, I don't know anything about money, and she throws up her hands, and she says, I'm just going to let my husband take care of it. And then the marriage goes sideways, and the husband becomes abusive, and she tries to leave, but she can't because she doesn't know where the accounts are, they're not in her name, and it just turns into a big mess. That's one reason you do it that way. The other reason you keep your money separate is because it cuts down or eliminates fights about money, right? So if you have a joint account and everybody's contributing to the joint account, if one person is spending a lot of money out of the joint account, then there's this mental accounting that goes on. Like, even though it's the money is commingled, like people keep track of what they put in. And then it turns into he's spending my money or she's spending my money. And then they get into fights about it. So keeping it separate just makes it a lot easier. Having said that, I know a lot of couples, most couples have joint accounts. Most couples pool their money and it works out fine. So if it works for you, then keep on doing it. But if it's not working, then maybe try it my way.
Yeah, that's such an important point. Like this whole idea of works for you is like so important in personal finance, investing, everywhere. Like, you know, what works for people, what works best for people is often the thing that they believe in, the thing they can stick with, you know, what works in their specific situation versus, you know, anybody else saying this is the exact way you have to do it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, nothing in this book is really prescriptive. There's no rules. Like one thing you'll notice about No Worries is that I don't have like 10 rules to do this or 7 rules to do this. It's really more of a philosophical book. It's more about principles, you know? So, and like you said, like if it works, then keep doing it.
You mentioned two sources of worry in the book that you're helping people to deal with, debt and risk. And I want to take those on one at a time. First of all, in your life, how do you think about debt? Like what is the role of debt in your personal finances?
I hate debt personally, and I hate paying interest, right? The concept of paying interest, just for example, let's say you have a $3,000 mortgage payment and $2,000 is interest and $1,000 is principal, right? So really, you have a $2,000 a month mortgage payment because $1,000 is going to principal and that's being allocated to the real estate portion of your portfolio, but you're paying $2,000 in interest. Are you getting any benefit or utility out of paying that interest? Is it fun to pay that interest, right? Like, is that something that you enjoy doing? Like, really, when you pay interest, philosophically, you're contributing to bank profits, right? And I'm not one of these anti-bank people. I don't dislike banks. Banks can help you achieve a lot of goals, but I don't want to make banks any more profitable than they already are. The last mortgage I had, the house, I'm actually moving very soon. But on the house that I'm living in, I paid off the mortgage in 3.5 years. And in the 3.5 years that I had the mortgage, I paid $70,000 in interest. And I said to myself, like, what could I have done with that $70,000? You know, I hate paying interest. But your original question was about stress. Debt is a source of stress. If you have a lot of debt, whether it's credit card debt or student loans or car loans or mortgages, it hangs over your head and it causes you lots of stress.
Yeah. And I think this is a big time where you have to separate sort of the numbers from your personal situation. Like, I know a couple of people who've paid off their mortgage and just what was lifted off their shoulders was huge. You know, you can get the finance types like me, it'll be like, well, you know, you have a 3% mortgage and you can earn 5% short term. Why would you possibly pay off the mortgage? But you can't quantify that part of the equation.
No. And, you know, there's been a couple times in my life where I've owned my house free and clear without a mortgage. It is the best thing in the world. Owning your house free and clear, you own it. Like, there's nothing bad that can happen. You could get into a car accident. You could have $2 million in medical bills. You own your house free and clear. Nobody can take it away from you. It's the best feeling in the world.
How do you think about debt as it relates to cars? You know, that's something there's a lot of debate about as well. You know, some people will say there should never be any debt related to a car. It's a rapidly depreciating asset. You know, you should just buy cars you can pay for. Other people will say, you know, well, I enjoy having a car. Like, I'm willing to have a payment. Like, how do you think about that?
Well, there's a saying that you should never have debt on something that can rust.
I never heard that. That's good.
It's a depreciating asset, as you said. I mean, the problem is that the average new car in the United States is $46,000. And 90% of cars are financed in the U.S. Only 10 are paid with cash. It's very hard to pay cash for a car, especially if you're starting out, you're in your 20s, you're in your early 30s. Maybe you can afford a car that's $15,000 or $20,000. Then you're looking at used cars, and then you're getting into the hell of mechanical problems and cars that smell like cigarette smoke and stuff like that. So, you know, the reality is that you're probably going to have some debt on a car. And the goal is to get a 5-year loan, not an 8-year loan, but a 5-year loan, and pay it off as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the book, you know, you're kind of like me. Like, I tend to be a very like frugal person, but you evolved over time, right? You're not saying like people shouldn't have a nice car. I think you evolved to have a nice car over time. You know, you're just saying like to do it in a financially smart way.
Yeah, there is actually, I didn't write about this in the book, but there's a rule of thumb that says that you can buy a car, and this is kind of a draconian rule, but you can buy a car that costs 10% of your income. Okay. So if you make $800,000 a year, you can buy an $80,000 car. I think that's a little strict. I think 15 or 20% is probably a better number, but that just gives you a general guideline of the kind of car that you can get. And look, if you're making 7 figures, then you can buy a supercar, you know, for sure. You can afford it.
I want to ask you about this idea of getting the big decisions right. Because one of the things I hate that you see on Twitter all the time is like the person that says, you know, well, your coffee is $4.43.
Oh my God.
If you didn't buy the coffee and it compounded over 30 years, you would have $200,000 or something. Like, and I think that sort of just loses track about what's important in life. So how do you think about this idea of like these small decisions versus the bigger decisions?
I mean, the big stuff, you know, Americans, we have this perverse obsession with like little stuff that doesn't matter, you know, like making your bed. I don't make my bed in the morning. I don't. It doesn't matter. What's the point? I'm just going to get in it at night, and it's like 5 minutes out of the day that I could be spending doing something else that's more productive. Like, I'm not a person that believes that we are the accumulation of millions of small habits, right? So when you talk about the coffee costs $4 a day. If you buy coffee 225 days a year, which is how many days you're going to work. That's $900 a year. That's, if you work for 40 years, that's $36,000. If you invest it, maybe you have $100,000. So great. If you don't drink coffee for the rest of your life, then you can have $100,000. So the math works, like the math checks out. The problem is it's a small luxury, and we cannot give up small luxuries. We can give up big luxuries, but we can't give up small luxuries. So the obverse of that is if you get a house that's 500 square feet smaller, costs $100,000 less, maybe more, you spend $200,000 less in interest over the life of the loan, you just saved a couple $100,000 on one decision versus $100,000 on millions of decisions, right? And we can give up large luxuries. If you get a slightly smaller house, you're not in the house saying, this house sucks, I hate it, I can't wait to move out of here. No, you're sitting in the living room, you're watching TV, it's fine. So it's not a million small decisions that determine whether we have money. It's a few big decisions. It's the house, the car, and the student loans.
And the other thing you touch on in the book is a lot of times people focus too much on the expense side of things. Like most people have probably more opportunity to improve their financial future on the income side of things than on the expense side of things.
Yeah. I mean, that's the personal finance world that we live in. You know, I'll beat up on Dave Ramsey a little bit, and I'll beat up on Susie Orman and all these other people, the FIRE people. Like, they're really focused on expenses. Like, when I was 25 years old, I was making $45,000 a year. And it was a little tight. I had a mortgage and I was paying for grad school. And I said, look, like, if I really went full austerity and I ate ramen noodles and did stuff like that, I could save $2,000 a year, right? But if I go get a job that pays more money, then I can make much more than $2,000 a year. So I went to grad school and I got a job on Wall Street. And in 5 years, I was making $850,000 a year, which was a much better use of my time than trying to figure out these ways to cut tiny expenses. It's called the revenue side. There's a whole chapter in the book called the revenue side. You know, there's all kinds of things that people can do to make more money. They can get a raise, they can work longer hours, they can get a second job, they can start a business, they can do passive income. And these things have a much bigger impact than cutting tiny expenses. And the other thing about this is cutting expenses sucks. Like, it's the worst. Like, austerity is the worst. But making more money is actually fun. Like, that's fun to do.
I'm curious, how do you think, and I think you may have figured this out, like, as you move forward in your life, how do you think about the balance between making money and doing something you love to do? Because you did the whole Wall Street thing, which is, many people say, is not the most enjoyable thing. You know, you have nothing, there's nothing in your life other than that. And now it seems like you're doing something a lot more flexible on your own that you enjoy doing and probably making a good amount of money doing it. So how do you think about that balance between doing something you love and also making money?
I mean, I'm the luckiest person in the world because I am doing something that I love. By the way, I make more money now than I did on Wall Street, which is crazy. You know, like, I've built a successful newsletter business. I've been doing it for 16 years and I'm doing what I love. I write, you know, I am a writer. So I'm probably one of the highest paid writers in the world. It is the greatest thing of all time. I wish everybody could have what I have. So
shifting to your portfolio, before I ask you about the awesome portfolio and what's in it, I want to ask you first about an emergency fund. You know, everybody needs to have some degree of cash in case something goes wrong. Like, before you start investing money, how do you think about that idea of an emergency fund? How much should be in it? Like, how do you think about that in the context of your life?
Yeah, I'm really big on emergency funds. And it's my opinion that they should be larger than what most people think. A lot of people say you should have emergency fund of about $3,000 or something like that. I think it should be much bigger. It should be 10,000 or 6 months worth of expenses, whichever is greater. That's my philosophy on emergency funds. I call it the sick pet fund, right? This is, I'm an animal lover. I have six cats. I love my cats, and I would pay anything to save my cats if something happened to them. And there's a lot of people, their dog or their cat gets sick, and they take it to the vet, and it's going to be $600, and they don't have the money. And it's called economic euthanasia. They actually have to euthanize the animal because they don't have the money to pay for medical treatment. That's what you have an emergency fund for. If everybody in the country had an emergency fund of even $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, do you know how many animals would be saved in this country just by having an emergency fund? It's just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, you know, we went through that with our dog where we had a big expense. And yeah, these can be $10,000+, you know, these types of things. And if you don't have the money, that's not a great situation. I want to ask you about, before I ask you about your portfolio, I want to ask you about the way most people save for retirement. You know, we've had this traditional approach of I've got my stocks, I've got my bonds, I've probably got some sort of glide path where the percentage between them is changing over time. But that's basically all I own. I mean, most people are using something along those lines. How do you think about that as a retirement portfolio?
Yeah, I think that's a very fragile portfolio because if you own stocks and bonds, you own a very specific kind of asset. You own financial assets. Stocks and bonds are financial assets. A lot of people, they have target date funds, they have 60-40 portfolios, and they say, look, like I have stocks and I have a mutual fund which has 500 stocks in it, so I'm diversified. And then I have this mutual fund that has 500 bonds in it, so I'm diversified. So I have stocks and bonds, so I'm diversified. You're absolutely not diversified. You need to have hard assets as well. So one of those is real estate. And the good news is that a lot of people do own real estate in some form if they own a house. So you need to be invested in real estate. And the other part of it is commodities. And I use gold as a proxy for commodities. You can pretty much just own gold and get away with it in terms of owning commodities, but you need to have exposure to these hard assets because what it does is you're introducing things into your portfolio that are either less correlated or negatively correlated, which reduces the volatility, okay? So even a 60-40 portfolio, you're going to take drawdowns of 20-25%, just like we did in 2022. You're going to take a 20 to 25% drawdown in a 60-40 portfolio. The portfolio I talk about in the book, which is the Awesome Portfolio, in 2008, during the financial crisis, it was only down 9%, right? And that's because of that diversification across asset classes.
Yeah, it's really interesting how when you have a 40-year period like we had where stocks and bonds do as well as they do, like it's so hard, you know, we're big believers in what you're saying. And we try to, you know, explain this to our clients too, but it was very hard to explain for a long period of time because the stocks and bonds were doing so well. So people would say, why do I need anything else? And then you have something like 2022 and it becomes clear, but it can be really difficult when that type of long period goes on where that type of strategy works.
Yeah, I think 2022 was kind of a wake up call. And also, you know, hard assets, you know, first of all, real estate has done really well. But commodities kind of bottomed about 7 months ago and are now starting to rally. And there's some evidence that we're entering into another period of inflation. So you really need to have this stuff in order to be fully diversified.
You mentioned the Awesome Portfolio. Can you just talk about what the five components of it are?
Yes. Yeah, so it's 20% stocks, bonds, cash, gold, and real estate. And you can do it with four ETFs and you have to have the cash. 20% cash in the portfolio. And when I came up with the Awesome Portfolio in 2019, a lot of people said I was nuts because cash was yielding zero, but now you're actually getting 5% on your cash. But the cash is important as a risk reduction tool. But I also talk about in the book about the option value of cash and why it's important to have a lot of cash around to take advantage of opportunities. But the Awesome Portfolio has returned 8.1% a year for the last 53 years with half the volatility of an 80-20 portfolio. And the biggest drawdown in any year was in 2022. It was down 12%. That's the worst year that the Awesome Portfolio had. In 53 years, it was down 12%.
So when you talk about you have in your personal portfolio, you have your very risky side and then you have your more conservative protective side. Is that what is the awesome portfolio? What fills that need?
Yep.
Okay. And how do you think about the balancing of the two? I mean, I know you said no one should follow what you're doing personally, but how do you think about the balancing between like the money you're putting in higher risk things and the money you have safe in the awesome portfolio?
You know, it's mental accounting. You know, money is fungible, right? So what I'm doing is actually irrational. And people do this. They, you know, they have 90% in safe stuff and 10% in risky stuff. You know, they might have crypto or something like that. And it doesn't, like, a behavioral economist would say this is totally irrational because money is fungible. But I think for mental accounting purposes, it works because you do need to have 80 to 90% of your portfolio in quote unquote safe things. Otherwise, you'll go nuts. So
how do you think about the whole index investing versus active thing? I mean, in the awesome portfolio, you just have a total market portfolio, which I think for most people makes a ton of sense. How do you think about the idea of, you know, well, active management, I should put in there some, or I should have some factors in there or things like that?
I am not a big fan of passive investing for a bunch of reasons. When you invest in an index, you get the returns of the index, which are superior, but you also get the volatility of the index, right? S&P 500 is a pretty volatile index. In any given year, it's going to move around 15 to 20%. And what we do in the United States is very unique and weird because the whole country invests their life savings in the stock market. Why? Because historically, over the last 100 years, it has worked. It has returned about 9% a year, 9.5% a year. Nobody does this in any other country in the world. They don't do it in Japan. They don't do it in Europe because they haven't seen those kinds of returns, right? So when I look at these people, they invest in the S&P and they say, I'm just going to hold this for 40 years. There's a couple things that are going on. One, over a 40-year period, you're going to take a 50% drawdown. That's going to happen, right? And I forgot what number two is.
Well, maybe number two is there could be long periods where it doesn't, you know, think of 2000 to 2009 because of that drawdown and didn't go anywhere for 10 years.
Yeah, you do have long periods of underperformance. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of the awesome portfolio, because the good thing about the awesome portfolio is it does deal with that to some degree because you've got all these other uncorrelated asset classes.
I mean, something is always working. Something is always working.
Yeah. So do you think from that perspective, like an index approach makes sense for the stock portion of that versus like more active approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of have to use an index for the stock portion. I mean, you could get cute about it. You can say, well, I think small caps are undervalued and I'm going to invest in small caps, but you could be dumb or unlucky and have a 20-year period of time where small caps have underperformed and it's going to kill your return. So I do think you have to have the broad market in the awesome portfolio. So
I'm just curious, because I don't know the answer to this. You mentioned that in Japan and in Europe, they do very different things to save for retirement. Like, what does that look like relative to what we do?
A lot of it is banks. I mean, a lot of it is keeping money in a bank or bonds. There's in Europe, people invest in bonds. You know, it's lower return, but, you know, the European stock markets have really gone nowhere for the last 20 years. I mean, this is a much longer discussion about why the U.S. has outperformed and all that stuff, but, yeah.
How about, because that sort of gets into my next question. How about international exposure? Because you'll have some people who say, you know, you have, based on like the numbers behind the scenes, you need to have international exposure in your portfolio. You want to get rid of that home country bias. And other people will say, well, the U.S. has a bunch of diversified companies. You're perfectly fine just owning the U.S. You don't need that. Where do you come down on that argument?
I actually tend to agree with that. The U.S., I would say in the last 25 years, has basically turned into a tech index, right? And one of the reasons that the U.S. market has outperformed for so long is because we have tech and nobody else does. And tech has grown the fastest, right? Europe doesn't really have any tech companies. Japan doesn't really have any tech companies. You're not seeing any tech companies in emerging markets. So that's why we've seen this outperformance in the U.S. But it is good to be diversified in internationally, because there will be periods of time when Europe or emerging markets or something else outperforms and the U.S. lags. Now, that hasn't happened in a long time. I actually have a little bit of exposure to emerging markets in a couple specific circumstances. So I do believe in that diversification.
I want to go back to the real estate portion you talked about, because one of the things you'll see a lot of experts say is you should not consider your house in terms of your portfolio. But in the book, you said, you know, if you do own a house, that should be considered as portion as the real estate portion of your portfolio. Like, how do you think about that idea of including your house in your portfolio or not including your house in your portfolio?
Yeah, I think it should be, because basically, if you're going to achieve this asset allocation, 20% stocks, 20% bonds, 20% cash, 20% gold, and 20% real estate, most people are over-allocated to real estate, right? They have a $700,000 house, and they have $400,000 in equity, and then they have $200,000 in a 401k. So they're massively overweight real estate relative to financial assets, right? So what they should do is increase their allocation to financial assets relative to real estate. So I think about everything in terms of, like, me right now, I am 50% real estate, and it makes me really nervous. I was actually talking to my wife on the couch last night. I said, look, like, I have a desire to, like, pay off the mortgage, but right now I'm massively overinvested in real estate, and I need to have more in stocks and bonds.
On the stuff you do outside of the Austin portfolio, I mean, we don't want you to name risky things you're doing, but how do you think about that? Is it like one-off opportunities you see where you're willing to bet big because you know you have the conservative money behind that? Like, how do you think about, like, what you're doing in that other portion of your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, just for example, like, you know, I can name one thing. This was about 6 months ago. You know, two-year interest rates were up over 5%, and at the time, inflation was about 2.5%, and Fed funds was 5.5%. And I said, look, like, you know, real rates are 3%, and monetary policy is pretty restrictive, and I think the Fed is going to get more dovish, and I think we might get some rate cuts. It sounded absurd at the time, but I took a large position in two-year note futures, and that was, you know, it was one of the best trades of my career. So like you said, it's very opportunistic. You know, if I see something like that, then I'll trade off of it. So.
And you use sort of the conservative portion of your portfolio to allow you to do that, right? So the fact, yep, that you know you have this safe money, you know, if these trades go against you, you're still in good shape.
Yep.
Just one more before I hand it back to Justin. I want to ask you about this idea of looking different than the market, because this is something we see, you know, when we run these types of portfolios for clients, we see this a lot, which is this idea that at the cocktail party, you know, you're talking to the guy that's in the S&P 500 or in the stock and bond portfolio. And when you have these portfolios that are more diversified, they have better risk-adjusted numbers over time, but they also in individual years can look very different than everybody else. And it tends to make investors tend to abandon them during periods like we just went through, where stocks and bonds are just beating that type of thing. What do you think about that? Do you have any tips for anybody to manage this idea of looking different than the market and looking different than your neighbor?
So I've actually done some research on that. Right. So the Austin portfolio, 42% of the time, it will lag the S&P by 10% or more. 21% of the time, it will beat the S&P by 10% or more. So basically, 42% of the time, you're experiencing FOMO, right? Like, you are going to cocktail parties. Everybody's talking about how rich they're getting in the stock market. You have this slow, boring, awesome portfolio, and it's tough, you know, because it seems like you're underperforming. But where it saves you is in the bad years. You know, like I said, in 2008, the awesome portfolio returned negative 9%. The S&P was down 38, right? So you're suppressing the volatility on the downside. So yeah, like, it psychologically, it can be difficult to hold on to that over a period of time. But you are trading away a little bit in the way of returns. You're trading away about a percent to a percent and a half. So you are going to get slightly lower returns than you are in the stock market, but you're going to be able to sleep at night, and that's the price that you pay.
Do you do anything in just thinking like startups, private equity, any alternatives, assets?
I have in the past, but I'm not right now. Okay. Yeah.
And what about crypto? How do you view that?
I've on balance, I've traded a little bit of crypto on balance. I've made money, but I'm not a believer. I'm more of an opportunistic trader. Look, like there's a big discussion right now about whether crypto is a store of value like gold is, like Bitcoin in particular. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, Bitcoin really behaves more like a risk asset. You know, during times of crisis or strife, Bitcoin actually goes down when gold goes up. I don't think it's really a safe haven asset at all. I think it's a risk asset. I think if we had a big bear market in stocks, we would probably also have a big bear market in crypto. So I don't think it does a lot in the way of diversification.
It's interesting. I was just today, they were talking about like, I don't know, Bitcoin is down like 8% and they're attributing it to the, you know, the Iran attack on Israel. So I'm trying to like square those two things. I'm like, well, wait a minute. What is driving that? Is it like, are West Israelis buying Bitcoin or I don't know. Just, it seems weird to me making that connection.
I think what happened in that particular instance was the attack happened over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And the financial markets was closed. And the only thing that people could sell was Bitcoin because it's open 24/7, you know, so they had to sell something.
Just on the point about alternatives, I'm curious about, you're seeing a lot of alternative hedge fund type strategies that used to be only available to richer investors come down to everybody now, like something like managed futures. There's a lot of managed futures ETFs now, whereas before you couldn't access that type of thing. What do you think about those types of strategies for investors?
I generally think it's good. You know, I think that also gives you diversification. I mean, I don't, you know, I think personally, I would rather, I don't know. You know, it's funny. I haven't put a lot of thought into it. What I was about to say was, I think I would rather have a commodity index than some allocation to managed futures. But I don't know, that might work as well too. So.
Even though you don't have kids, you have cats, and maybe the cats will be in the will. But you know, do you have any thoughts on leaving money to children and sort of where you fall? Like we've had some guests on that say, you know what, I just want to get my kids through college, then they're on their own. We've actually had other guests on that have kind of said, you know what, I think I actually have made a little bit of a mistake in giving my kids a little bit too much. And so I'm just curious as when you sort of, if you've given that any thought, where you sort of fall on that?
Well, like you said, I don't have kids, but I have all kinds of opinions on how other people raise their kids. So, no, I mean, look, like, I think leaving money to kids is, you know, I've seen it work out and I've seen it not work out. I've seen, kids that have inherited a lot of money turn out to be stinkers. And I've seen kids that have inherited a lot of money go on to be productive and do great things with the money. And they're terrific. I've seen both instances. And I really think it comes down to how you teach your kids about money when they're younger. You know what I mean? Like, I really think that's what it comes down to. So.
It's interesting too, like these days because people are living so much older, like if you're not giving your kids money till you die, I mean, a lot of times you're giving your kids money like in their 60s or something, so they're not even really kids anymore. That sort of plays into it as well.
Yeah.
When you think back on your sort of investing experience, the things that you've gotten right, but specifically the things that have gotten wrong, what do you think is the biggest mistake you've made with your investing portfolio, and what would you say you've learned from that?
Biggest mistake that I made was in 2017. I was trading Canadian short-term interest rate futures, and I put on a big bet that the Bank of Canada would cut rates, and they actually did the opposite. They hiked rates. They hiked rates 5 times. And I didn't close out the position, and I didn't double down on it because that's a trading no-no. But I held on to that position until the pandemic, and then rates went to zero, and I ended up making money. But for really 2017 and 2018, I was miserable. I lost like 20% of my net worth.
Oh, wow.
Like it was a really big hit. And, you know, that actually kind of informed my thoughts on stress around risk, right? Because, you know, for a period of about a year and a half or 2 years, I was really, really stressed out about this trade. Cause I didn't know how bad it could get. It could have gotten worse. And, it ruined a whole year of my life, you know? So I vowed never to do that again, you know?
So do you think the mistake was in the sizing of the position rather than what you did?
It was the sizing and the lack of discipline, for sure.
So as we get to the end of these, we like to get this idea that not everything in someone's portfolio is about making money. You know, I always give the example, I own a racing sailboat, and a racing sailboat is a horrible investment. It loses money, it needs to be maintained, but I get a lot of joy out of it. I love going out with my friends and doing races and having a beer, and you know, it gives me a lot of value in my life, even though it's not the greatest investment. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some things you have in your life, if you have anything like that, that is maybe not the greatest financial investment, but you get a lot of joy out of.
Well, it's actually my new house. Like, I just built a humongous, way too big that I need new house on 9 acres of land here in South Carolina. And it's way more house than I need, but it is going to bring me a lot of joy. It's almost done. And we go to the house every weekend and we see the progress. We see how it's being built, and it's absolutely phenomenal. And this is the house that I'm really going to spend the rest of my life in. We're not moving after this. Like, I'm going to spend, you know, the next 30 years in this house. And it's not the best financial decision in the world. You know, it is that the money I have put towards the house has crowded out money that I could have invested in other things. I have had opportunities that I've had to pass up, which were really good opportunities because I put the money in the house instead. So, but it's for my own personal enjoyment.
I'm curious, I really enjoyed like the renovation process too. Like, I found like when I renovated the house, they got a lot of fun out of picking out the stuff and just seeing it constructed. Like, I've really enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, it's been terrific. It's almost done. We're going to be moving in on May 6th. So
it's great. Just two more questions. And you might've hit on this a little bit at the beginning, but, and it's going to be different for every reader, but if you were to try to sum up the main takeaway that you hope someone gets from reading the book, from your perspective, what would that be?
It's the main takeaway is to focus on the big things like the house. Buying a house is the most important and riskiest financial decision you will ever make. And most people, when they go into the closing and they sign the loan documents, they are not nervous. They should be nervous, but they're not nervous. It's an incredible amount of debt. It's an incredible amount of risk. You know, it's only been 16 years since the financial crisis, and people have forgotten about the risk inherent in buying a house. It's a huge amount of risk. But if you get that decision right, one decision, it can set you up for life. Quick story. I bought my first house when I was 24 years old. Okay. I bought a condo in Walnut Creek, California for $175,000. Took all my savings, about $35,000, $40,000, used it as a down payment. Sold that place in 2 years for $300,000. So at age 27, I was debt-free and had $200,000 in the bank. Compared to all my 27-year-old friends that were loaded up on student loans and they didn't have any savings, I was in an unassailable financial position, right? So that was one decision and I got it right. And that's really what set me up for the rest of my life.
And this might relate to the standard closing question we have, which we always like to ask our guests, if you could impart one lesson that you learned on building your portfolio to the average investor, what would that be?
You have to avoid the cemetery. You have to avoid the, really, like, in, you know, investing is there's two parts of this. A lot of people focus on the one big win that will set them up for life, right? So let's say you go, this is a dumb example, but let's say you get a job in NVIDIA and you get stock options and now you're worth $20 million, right? So that one decision sets you up for life. Most people are focused on the positive aspect of that. You also have to be focused on the negative aspect of that. You have to avoid the catastrophic losses, right? Because that can set you back years if you have a catastrophic loss. So that would really be my piece of advice.
Good stuff, Jared. Thank you very much. This has been a very sort of straightforward conversation. I think our audience is going to get a lot from it, and we wish you all the best with the book.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at JJ Carbonell. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.